sit down and show me these all and figure out these.
Good time.
Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2017. Today on the agenda, we're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 5002, Department of Administrative Services. And my understanding is George and Madeline, you folks are coming up. Director, did you want to come up first? Come on up. And why don't we start off with Paul if there's any beginning comments for us.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I believe that we got some responses from DAS. I'll have to check and see if they've been posted to OLIS. If they haven't, we'll make sure they are right after the meeting.
Perfect. Perfect. And committee, I'd remind each of you, this is the time to really be asking those questions that are on your mind. I know the agency will do all they can to help us. All right. So welcome, Madam Director. We're glad you're here.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Katie Koba, State COO and Director of DAS. And we are starting today with day two of the budget review for the Department of Administrative Services. I have a few slides that I will be going over, and then we're going to hear from George Naughton, the Chief Financial Officer, and Madeline Zeig, the Chief Human Resources Officer. So I wanted to give a bit of an overview of the Office of the Chief Operating Officer, me, and DAS Director, and really show you what is in our office. It includes strategic communications, legislative coordination, Office of Economic Analysis, internal audits, statewide initiatives, and then DAS IT. And as I spoke yesterday, when the split was made in 2015 and the state CIO was directed off into its quasi-standalone entity, DAS IT stayed within the department and was, from an organizational standpoint and budget standpoint, housed in the COO, but from a workings standpoint, it's in the Chief Administrative Office. So you'll hear more about DAS IT tomorrow when we're talking about the Chief Administrative Functions.
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
May I just lay down a marker that that's something that I really want to follow? I frankly worry that we have hired somebody who was sort of designated the new cop in town, Dr. Pettit, and he was supposed to come here and share with us best practices, and then he gets pulled out of the agency for what are ostensibly, in my view, political reasons. And I wonder, in the reporting structure that it is right now, is he shooting rubber bullets as the new sheriff, or is he? I just am very concerned about the alignment, and I know that there's a bill to perhaps create another agency. I don't want to keep playing agency roulette. I think the fact that we're moving this around is an indication that nobody's happy about what's happening. But it matters less to me where the chief operator or the chief IT officer sits than it does what they do. And I think it's something that we ought to seriously talk about. I know security has been one of his priorities, but I still get the impression, the way that this is all constructed, that we're remarkably vulnerable. Scenic still doesn't work. He's isolated away. I mean, he may physically sit over there, but the reporting order doesn't make any sense to me the way it is now. And so I am very interested in hearing a lot more about how our chief information officer works.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, Thursday is the day when the CIO will be in front of you, and I would direct your questions to him on that day.
Okay. One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
Would you remind us, because memory grows foggy, what is under that sort of grab bag of statewide initiatives?
I'm going to get to that in just a minute.
Cool.
All right.
So really quick, in our preparation for Thursday, can you please pass along to him that we're also looking for what are those, using Senator Johnson's analogy, what are those bullets that he needs to do his job effectively?
Yep.
And if you could just ask him to be prepared to talk with us about that.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll turn the floor over to you, Madam Director.
And I just remembered there was one issue that I did want to circle back with you briefly on that we discussed yesterday when we were talking about the enterprise leadership team, and we had a discussion about the fact that the Board of Chiropractic Examiners is a small board that serves on the ELT to try to get at the concerns of our small boards and commissions that maybe feel a little disconnected from the rest of us. I wanted to clarify for everyone, the Board of Chiropractic Examiners was just added to ELT, and they attended their first meeting last week. So this is a new initiative on my part to have a little more outreach to small boards and commissions. That's one way to do it. But we are also we have quarterly all agency director meetings, which all small agencies, boards, and commissions participate in with DAS. And then we have also set up an every 6 month outreach to the small boards, commissions, and independent agencies to talk about what's happening in the governor's office, what DAS provides, answer their questions, making sure they're feeling like they're getting the information that they need to operate effectively. So we're trying to do a little more outreach for the small boards and commissions. But if you had I don't think they come in front of this committee, but if you had the Board of Chiropractic Examiners in this committee and you asked, so how's it like to be part of ELT? They'll say, well, we just started, and I wanted to clarify that for you.
Perfect. Yes, Sandra.
How did you select them out of all the boards and commissions? Because you left somebody on the cutting room floor.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, you're right. And I selected them because their executive director came up to me at the last six-month meeting of small boards and commissions and independent agencies and said, if you're looking for someone, I'm interested in serving. And to me, that was as important a factor as someone that is interested. And I asked, would you be willing to be kind of a connectivity back out to small boards and commissions, attending their get-togethers and talking about what we're doing at ELT and kind of being that voice back and forth? And she said, yes, she was. So we're giving it a try. Okay. So going back to each of the boxes in a little more detail, we have legislative coordination in the state COO's office. They provide objective and accurate information to legislators, at least that's the intent. Coordinates agency engagement and also provides procedural support to state agencies. So this would be an example of when we're doing agency legislative concepts, we have a person within DAS that really kind of coordinates that effort amongst all state agencies, helping the governor's office as they're doing that work.
Yep. Senator Johnson?
May I have a list from you of all of the legislative liaison from all of the agencies, as well as a list of every agency's PIO?
I can check to see if we have that, and if we have it, we'll get it to you, and if not, we'll let you know what it might take for us to get it.
Good. I see heads nodding behind you saying
that's
that good. You have it, and I would hope that you would, given that legislative coordination is one of your responsibilities, and if you don't know who the players are, it's hard to call in the plays.
Mr. Kosher, Senator Johnson, I did make a disclaimer yesterday that I've been 4.5 months on the job, and I don't know everything yet about the agency, so when you look behind me and they're nodding their heads, that's a good sign.
And Senator, I have to share with you really quick, because you've been taking care of very important business in some other areas. We have many new members on this committee, and so as chair, I've decided we're going to limit acronyms as much
Principal
as possible.
Principal Information Officers. Each one of the agencies has spokespersons and spinmeisters and principal information officers and legislative liaisons, and I want a playbook of who all those guys are.
You're awesome.
Can I get that too? Can you share that with
me? Oh, I'm asking on behalf of the whole committee.
We'll share it with staff to get to members.
So that's a great 101, just really quick. So when any one of us asks for that type of question, folks will circulate it to all of us. So, yeah.
Okay.
Please continue.
All right. Office of Economic Analysis, I think you're familiar with them. They issue the revenue and economic forecasts that you all use as you develop your budget and the governor uses as she develops her budget. Issues the corrections population forecast and the juvenile corrections population forecast. Internal audits, we have one staff person that is our internal auditor for DAS. And I think that's a pretty straightforward function in terms of what an internal auditor does. Strategic communications, this is our PIO and support staff to do a lot of work really in terms of coordinating public outreach efforts among state agencies, technical and substantive communication support. This is a place that we look to respond to public records requests, that kind of work. Statewide initiatives.
Mr. Chair. Yep, Senator Johnson.
Sorry. Responding to public information requests, do you have internal policies, Madam New Director? And I just have to say, for anybody that's listening, my irritation, Katie and I have known each other a long time, and I consider her a friend and a colleague. I've sat in this same hearing room for a really long time, and practically every year I've been here, there's been a new head of DAS. And there is a propensity to have the new director sit here and blame the dead guy. And you're not blaming anybody, but I'm just saying that there's been kind of a revolving door with directors. Do you have policies with respect to timeliness on the response to public records? This has been quite much in the press. And so is there a prescriptive timeline by which your communication folks must respond?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, this has been a focused effort of in the last year in terms of how state agencies respond to public records requests. And speaking from the perspective of someone that was in a state agency for many years, up until recently, agencies were really on their own in terms of response times, in terms of what kinds of fees they would charge, when they would start the clock ticking on a fee. There was a work group made up of governor's office staff, our staff, and agency folks to really look at more of a statewide policy around public records and a statewide fee schedule. We've just adopted a statewide fee schedule from a policy perspective, and we're looking to let that operate for a few months, and then we'll probably go into rulemaking on that. So there has been a lot of focus on this in order to try to do a better job of standardizing how agencies respond to public records requests.
Please.
Will the rulemaking have an advisory committee, and will members of the press and others who have been consistent critics have a seat at the table to review the promulgation of the rule?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I don't think we've gotten yet to that point in terms of the process for the rulemaking. I can make a note of that. And I assume that you think that would be a good idea.
I think that would be a dandy idea, Madam Chair. I mean, Madam Director. The other thing is that I don't know with whom the fee schedule was vetted. There are those that believe that we constructively deny access to records by onerous charges for fees that should be in the public square. I mean, for documents that should be in the public square.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, it was vetted quite extensively through state government, and I know that some agencies were concerned because I believe, don't hold me to this, I believe the first 30 minutes now are free for everyone, and that was not the case for all agencies, and there was concerns around that and what the implications would be.
First 30 minutes of what?
Of the work that agencies do to respond to public records requests. So if it's a fairly small request and you can get that work pulled together in less than 30 minutes, I think we probably better get back to you and get... We can give you the policy that's just been issued.
I think the committee would like to see that because in that first 30 minutes, if that's just chatting time or if there are copies that have to be made or... electronic transfers of information. I'm just trying to get a sense of what it is. And colleagues, in the shameless self-promotion area, I would mention that there may be a bill that would direct some of those public information officers within agencies to have the formal responsibility to respond to public records. What I'm trying to ferret out is whether or not you're trying to consolidate all those responses within Department of Administrative Services.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, no.
Okay.
Okay. Statewide initiatives. These are staff positions, project managers in the COO's office whose responsibility is to provide staffing to support specific long-term enterprise projects. So we talked a lot yesterday about ELT and some of the projects that ELT has undertaken. These are four positions in the COO's office that would staff those efforts. When I came into this position, all four of those positions were vacant and are vacant. And so I've been looking at the structure of the COO's office and the work that ELT does in trying to determine the best way to staff some of those statewide initiatives. We're on our cut list for DAS. We're eliminating two of those four positions. I'm still not exactly sure what the right staffing and where that staff should exist in terms of doing this work. I think there are people that have concerns about eliminating those positions, but we're still trying to figure out the best way to support that. And so we're keeping two of the four, but right now we have two on the cut list.
Would you go, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Would you go back to the last slide? I still don't know what long-term enterprise projects are.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, one example of those projects that was discussed yesterday was the leasing project that was undertaken to relook at the way the state issues all of its leases and renegotiate some of the terms of those. The outcome of that effort was an estimated $60 million in savings over the coming life of those leases. That's one example of a project that ELT has undertaken. Another example is the public records work that's ongoing. So those are just a couple of examples.
One more follow-up. Mm-hmm, so I understand then project direction is provided by the governor. I get that. DAS is her agency. The legislature, I presume that would be bills that were passed, and we give you specific legislative direction. DAS director, that's you. I understand that. And the enterprise leadership team, do they all have to agree? Is this by consensus? Do you all stand up and say this is a great idea? How does the governance work?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, it depends. There is, when we're talking about the enterprise leadership team, the goal is that we all agree and that we have consensus. And I can't think of a period of time over the last 6 years that I've served on the ELT where we've had disagreement. There may be times where the DAS director just says this is the way it's going to be, or the governor says this is the way it's going to be, and that's happened as well. And so it's not hard and fast rule for every issue that we're dealing with. You're going to hear a little more about an enterprise leadership team project that's ongoing right now, the Human Resources Information System. I spoke to it quite a bit yesterday, and you're going to hear more about that today, which is also staffed by project managers, kind of housed within DAS, but ELT is sponsoring that project.
So, Senator Johnson, really quick, yesterday one of the questions I asked was, how do we quantify their success? How do we quantify to see that they're achieving the right objectives, et cetera? And I'm not sure how we go about that. I don't want to discourage the groups from meeting because I think it's a smart move. At the same time, I think that there ought to be a way to quantify that so we can show your success. But I don't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you because as long as I've been sitting here, we've been talking about the HR management system, and we've been talking about classification, and we've been talking about a lot of stuff that I presume has come through the enterprise leadership team. Some of those initiatives are 15 years old and still not, to the best of my knowledge, completed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the Human Resources Information System, I think Paul gave us a date yesterday. Since 2012, you're going to hear where we're at. There is a pop in our budget. We're much closer, and you're going to hear more about that today. The Oregon Management Project, which did the work on the classification system, continues on. So
and on.
It's complicated.
Mr. Chair, I would ask the professional staff if they wouldn't mind to give the committee an amalgam report on how much money has been spent on these two initiatives to this point. One of them goes back to 2012, and I'm not trying to hang these around the new director's neck, but I'm just saying either these aren't priorities or it's unfixable or there's not enough money in the world, but that classification system, Mr. Chair, that's been around as long as you have been sitting on this committee, as have I. And I'm just wondering how much money we've spent to this point in time to judge efficacy. One of my yardsticks is how much money you spent and what's the end product look like. Paul can tell us how much money we've spent. We still don't have an end product.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, you're going to get a summary of the amount that's been spent on HRIS up to this point in time later today. The classification and compensation system was... staff and employee time. It's not a it's not an IT project, if that there's a distinction. So I don't know that we can go back and quantify the amount of staff time. The work was has been done, and it's kind of sitting in a place. There are challenges with moving from the current management classification system to a new classification system. And so it hasn't been thrown away. I've spent a lot of personal time on that effort.
Just a snarky editorial comment. We tend to ignore complicated problems, and they don't get better. I can think of one that's four letters.
Okay.
Let's continue.
All right.
So, Chief Operating Office budget over time, you'll see a big jump and wonder probably what that is due to. And that is due to that piece that I mentioned, the DAS IT staff that were moved into the COO's office when the OSCIO spun off onto its own. So this is not new.
What is it again?
Oregon State Chief Information Officer. Sorry.
Thank you.
OSCIO.
Thank you. I had to think about that myself.
Yeah. So this is not new money in the 15-17 biennium budget. It's just moving from where IT used to be captured to the DAS internal IT staff now being budgeted within the director's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, but on some of the stuff where pieces have been moving from different parts of the agency, it might be helpful to look at combine what's happening to those budgets. There was a question yesterday from Representative March about sort of similarly about the number of FTEs, and just to look at understand that there's a big jump because of that move, but to be able to look at the combined numbers.
So we're, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Fahey, we're showing you today, you'll see the COO chunk, you'll see the CFO budget, you'll see the CHRO budget.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, this Chief Administrative Office budget. And then I showed you yesterday the whole agency budget. We can flip back to that really quick.
Okay.
I don't think it gets at being able to really identify where it came from and where it went to, because it is such a large budget.
Okay.
But we can also think about if there's a better way to display that. We'll put our heads together and see what we can come up with that shows you a little better tracking.
Even if it was just the two places where it came from and went to.
Okay.
Combined.
Okay. And then the reductions that are included in the governor's budget for the chief operating office, as I mentioned, there are the two positions that are the project manager positions that are being eliminated. That would leave two positions. And then, as is true for every state agency, the IT security position, the information technology security position that has been in DAS's budget is being transferred to the Chief Information Office budget. And so yesterday when we were talking about those state agency positions, this is DAS's position that's being moved out of DAS into the Chief Information Officer on the security piece. So that is my overview of the Chief Operating Office. And now we're ready to go to the Chief Financial Office, if you all are ready to do that. And I'm going to have George come up and walk you through that.
All right, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, George Naughton. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the State of Oregon and work for Director Koba. We're going to walk through a few slides here, just orienting you to the budget for the Chief Financial Office. And as you can see, there's really five sections underneath what is under my purview, basically. Four of them are directly inside the budget for the Chief Financial Office, and the one on the far right has a dotted line, because while it reports to me directly, in the budget is actually a separate budget structure. So as we work with Mr. Siebert about how the budget should be organized by appropriation level, DAS Business Services, which is the budget shop that does the budget for the Department of Administrative Services itself, is done by that other unit that's in a separate appropriation. The other four to the left are really a statewide control function. That is what all four of those are. And we'll walk through this in a little bit, but in a high level, The budget and management section is a series of analysts that work, just like your legislative fiscal analysts work, overwatching the spending inside of state government. Statewide audit and budget reporting and the capital finance and planning sections, I will get into a little bit more detail in just a moment, but they're really overwatching how the state spends its bonding capacity and works very closely with the legislative fiscal office and the CFO on how to make sure that rules are complied with. Statewide accounting and reporting is really the unit that sets the statewide accounting policy and also is responsible for putting together the state's annual, comprehensive annual financial report, our balance sheet, if you will. So looking at the next, I'm just going to walk through these in a little bit more detail, these five different sections. And this group, the first three that are here, which were the first three on the left-hand side of the prior chart, this is really the budget development function, the central budget development function. Every state agency has their own budget shop. It's a strategic function inside of agencies. We have a $74 billion biennial budget for the state of Oregon and 41,000 people. It is a lot of people that are out there. And each of these agencies have their own strategic person that's inside their agency and their own staff, helping the agency director make strategic decisions about their individual components of that budget. What these functions do is really provide the oversight and the overwatch to make sure that the way that the budget is supposed to be presented and guided and discussed comports with what legislative fiscal officer wants and what the chief financial officer wants. So this is really that control function piece. The budget and management section is really the analyst types. These are the counterparts to the legislative fiscal office. As I said, like legislative fiscal office with Mr. Siebers assigned to watch over DAS, Department of Ministry of Services. Patrick Heath, who's to my right, is the analyst that watches over DAS's budget on the chief financial office side. So we have a series of analysts that are assigned to each different agency. The next two are actually a support function that provides direct support to both legislative fiscal officer and the chief financial officer. The first one is what we call the statewide audit and budget reporting section. We have a relational database that we use to actually collect all the budget information for all the variety of programs throughout state government. We work closely with the legislative fiscal office to figure out what is the right level of organizational structure that will provide information so you can make decisions and the governor can make decisions, and we're the staff behind the scenes to actually help guide that conversation. This unit of about five people are the ones that maintain that system and work with agencies to make sure that they appropriately budget information in the correct places. So you can look at these folks as auditor types, who as we give direction, legislative fiscal office gives direction to make sure that the agencies put it where we told them to actually put the information. So that's a direct service, and Mr. Rocco in the past has been very clear with me that this unit and the next one work as much for him as they do for me. The last section on this page, capital finance and planning, is really as the state of Oregon over the last 20 years or so has increased the amount of debt that is issued on an ongoing basis. We issue debt through the Capital Construction Committee of this Ways and Means Committee. That debt is managed by two different organizations. It's partly managed by the Department of Ministry of Services and partly by the Treasurer's Office. The way this group works is this provides staff work to help guide me and the governor, as well as provide information to the legislative fiscal office on debt management practices and help run the behind-the-scenes numbers for both of our office that price when a project comes up, for example, how do we move a project to actually moving into being debt financed, how much interest do we have to do, what's the life of the loan. The staff to actually do that work live inside the chief financial office and, again, work directly for the legislative fiscal office and for the chief financial office. Those are the three sections that are really budget support functions inside of the chief financial office. The next two units are the ones that are non-budget related. The statewide accounting and reporting section, again, they're the ones that set the statewide accounting policy. They do not maintain the actual accounting system. That is actually operated by another section inside of DAS. But this is the one that sets the accounting policy of what's allowed, for example. We've been in conversation just within this last week of reversing some agencies' transactions that we thought were inappropriately done. This is the group that basically weighs in on what's the right way to make that work. The other thing is every year they produce the state's annual financial report, which is used by both of our offices and then also financial reporting organizations to evaluate how good or creditworthy is the state of Oregon.
So let me ask you a question on that. In a typical audit, there's usually a management report at the end. When this work is being completed, is there a management letter that and I apologize, I don't know the correct terminology.
Mr. Chair, there certainly is. So the CAFR itself, the Comprehensive Financial Report, is a document about this thick. It is compiled inside the Chief Financial Office, is then sent to the Secretary of State. They audit all the numbers, and then they give a recommendation on whether they think it's a clean bill of health, for example. Then there's a management letter that's signed off on me, and it's then presented on a go forward.
And really quick, this is a 101 for me. Mm-hmm. So, Paul, do you get a copy of that?
Oh, we get a copy.
Okay. Got it. I appreciate it. I didn't know how that worked.
And then the last section I'll talk about, actually I will mention this because this is important. We'll come back to this in a second. 2 years ago, there was a Senate Bill 55 that was passed specifically on delinquent and liquidated debt collection. I know Representative Gomberg will be very interested in this. Back in prior to 2008, there was a central state controller division, which has subsequently recombined into other places inside the Department of Administrative Services. But central debt collection and debt management was performed inside the Department of Administrative Services. During the recession in 2008, as we went through another round of budget cuts, that central control or oversight function was eliminated. And as part of that, the data integrity, I think, over time went fallow for a while. So 2 years ago, the legislature, through Senate Bill 55, added back that reporting requirement again. And over the last 2 years, the Department of Administrative Services, specifically over the last year, has spent a lot of work working with agencies trying to increase liquidated and delinquent debts. And as Representative Gomberg mentioned yesterday, when you look at the Department of Administrative Services list, there's, I will just say it generally speaking, there is about, 3 years ago, there was about $3.1 billion of uncollected debt, $3.1 billion. Two years ago, it went to $3.0 billion. And I think the report that's going to come out from Legislative Fiscal Office in the near future, and we have run a management report as well that came out at the end of December, we're projecting about $3.3 billion of delinquent debt that's outstanding in the current, basically how much is currently on the books.
Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. And thank you for referencing this important topic. I've actually gone over your very excellent report several times, but if I read that correctly, because we have, under Senate Bill 55, added 19 agencies back into the reporting process that were not earlier included in that, the number's gone up from $3.2 to $3.9 billion.
Chair Smith, Representative Gomberg, it would have been about $3 billion and has gone up to about $3.3. So the $3.9 billion number, as far as what's delinquent and liquidated debt, 3.3 is a number that's in my brain.
You have anything further at this time, Representative Gomberg?
Give me just a second. I'll be fine. Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you for that clarification. Yeah. I just think it's important to note that we've added 19 agencies back into the reporting process,
Yes. And
that has an effect on the bottom line.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg, what I will tell you is partly what's been happening over the last 4 years is that when you look at the number from 3 years ago at $3.1 billion, and then you look at why it dropped to $3.0 billion. It dropped because we pulled the university system out of those reporting numbers. With the change that happened in Senate Bill 55, we moved 20 organizations back in, which is what has caused it to go up to 3.3. If you excluded those 20 agencies, it goes down to about the $3 billion number again.
And Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, I just want to say that Mr. Naughton is absolutely correct. The number in his reporting is 3.3 with the additional 20 agencies added back in.
Correct. So, Mr. Chair, to follow along this line, we are spending a lot of energy trying to figure out, going back and digging through this information to find out where the liquidated and delinquent debt actually is. When you look at it in total, 50% of it is sitting in the Judicial Department, and 90% of the liquidated and delinquent sits in about five different agencies. Judicial Department, Department of Justice, the Employment Department, Department of Revenue, and DOJ. Department of Justice. Oh, I'm sorry. Oregon Health and Science University is the fifth one. Those are big dollar amounts, and some of those, what makes this process challenging is if you look at the Judicial Department, for example, these are actually criminal fines and assessments that are charged against criminals in the court system that may be in prison at this point and cannot pay back. So what we're trying to do is actually spend a lot of effort and have over the last 2 years setting a common base of information and then helping provide training opportunities for the agencies. Now, and this is the part Representative Gomberg will not like, and I don't like necessarily either. When we get to the last part of this budget, as we had to make difficult choices in a $1.8 billion budget gap, we have proposed in the governor's budget eliminating those two positions that do that central control. So this is another round of conversations that we have that's very similar to then 2008. So that's just a preview of the conversations that will continue forward.
Okay, I have two in the queue right now. Co-chair?
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. I actually have a number of questions, but I'm going to hold off on them, and we'll have them at a future time. But I do have one question. I want to go back to that comprehensive annual financial report. Do legislators get a copy of that?
Mr. Chair, we send it to the legislature. I'm not sure how it actually gets distributed.
Because of the nature of this committee, would it be possible for you to electronically send each of us a copy?
Mr. Chair, we certainly could.
And is there anything in that that is significant that we should be aware of?
So, Mr. Chair, I will tell you from my experience as the Chief Financial Officer, the Comprehensive Financial Report, which we call the CAFR, you'll hear it referred to that way, is an accounting document.
Sure.
When we build a budget every 2 years, the way we do it for building the budget is in organizational structures that make sense to decision makers. The Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, because it's in the accounting side, for a lot of people that are not accountants by background are probably not going to understand the vast majority of what's into it. In fact, when we've gone into it, both Legislative Fiscal Office and Chief Financial Office have to do a fair amount of interpreting what that means. The numbers line up between what you see in the budget and what's reported in the annual financial report. But the annual financial report is a one-year snapshot. It's done at the end of every fiscal year.
Right.
And as you all know, you budget on a biennial basis. So there's inherently confusion right off the bat of what should be in year one versus year two, because spending is not equal across two fiscal years.
So I guess I want to go back to the management letter that I asked about. Is there anything in that, in the management letter, that's noteworthy?
Mr. Chair, I would say that everything that is listed in there are things that you already know because of where you sit on the budget committees.
Got it.
Okay. The things that are highlighted in there are things related to what the state's collections look like, what we're facing over the next 2 years, major initiatives.
The typical ongoing issues we're dealing with.
That's okay. Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Just for the benefit of our new folks, we're sitting now through Ways and Means on the Road. And last Friday, we heard the lamentations of many, and on Saturday, many more, talking about the paucity of money that we have available for essential services. We have $3 billion in uncollected debt. And I credit Representative Gomberg for being a champion on this. But it's another one of those situations where I keep sort of hearing you can't get there from here. And I'm not blasting you, Mr. Naughton, about this. But I understand you can't get money out of people who are incarcerated. But one of the other problems are tax scoff laws at DOR. Most Oregonians step up and righteously pay their taxes. There is a subset that don't, and I don't know how aggressive we've been in going after them. And I hear periodically, well, we don't want to make anybody in the agency mad who's been doing debt collection by turning these over to private debt collectors. I don't know how efficacious private debt collectors are. But it frequently seems to me as though this is another one of these situations, just like PERS, where you go, God, this is hard and complicated. We just can't get there from here, and we shelve it. And in the meantime, we're going to cut schools, possibly we're going to cut health care, and $3 billion of uncollected debt is out there. And I just yearn for an aggressive plan to try to get that back, not just the reporting of why it's so hard. I'd like some leadership on what we can do to go get it.
Before you answer that, the co-chair and I had some conversation yesterday regarding exactly that. Where are we going to look for the money and how we're going to actually attack and recover the money. I had spoken a bit to Representative Nerman to try to pique a little interest about whether or not this committee would like to form some type of what did we say on that, Co-Chair?
Subcommittee.
Yeah,
subcommittee.
Of this subcommittee. Yeah, to look specifically into that and ways of that we can identify and actually find ways to come up with maybe some means of recovering some of that money. So we'll be checking with the membership and find out what the temperature is and, you know, to get on board and see if we can put some of that together. I think it's very important because now, and I agree with Senator Johnson, you know, if we've got billions of dollars out there that's uncollectible, what is collectible and what's not? And, you know, let's not inflate the books if something is not doable. It makes us look really bad. Representative Marsh.
Yeah, on this subject, you said when you recounted the most recent history, it was about $3 billion every year, give or take a little bit. Is that true going back 5 years?
So, Chair Smith, Representative Marsh, I think that because of the nature of where the debt is and because it is a large 50% of it is generated through the judicial system,
mm-hmm.
I think over time that number will continue to creep up because you have some of these debts, if you look at a court system, for example, will be on the books for 20 years because that person actually gets a judgment against them. They have to file restitution. They have to pay people back. That restitution may be on our books for the entire time they could be in prison, for example, and very little chance of actually collecting. I think the more important thing is what Senator Manning is talking about, Chair Manning is talking about. What can we do that show we're increasing collections? And that's where really our focus is. And actually, in the 2016 report, I think collections are going up from where they were 2 years ago. And also as part of the budget, again, while this team is being proposed for elimination for the next 2 years, they are proposing legislation in front of you, which I believe is Senate Bill 89. I could be mm-hmm. incorrect about
89.
That. Senate Bill 89 that centralizes those collection functions into the Department of Revenue, and there is a package in the governor's budget to add staff to the Department of Revenue to more aggressively go through that collection process. And if they can't get it, turn it over more quickly to private collection agencies. So we are actively trying to work in this area. What I'm trying to, in the big picture, trying to tell you from my standpoint, specifically Representative Marsh, while we may increase collections, the number of additions of new delinquent debt coming on also continues to increase. So the measure, I think, for success comes down to how much are we actually collecting over time and can we improve that over time?
Yeah.
Representative Gomberg.
I'm sorry.
Just a follow-up, if I may.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I think that was the point I was getting to, is that there's a certain churning that goes on. There is debt that is paid off. There is debt that accumulates over that time. If you have a fairly stable base, it sort of suggests that that's the really difficult nugget right there. And so if you can collect 80% of what comes in the door or some set percentage, then I think you have a fairly successful program in place. But that base is, you know, unless you do an accounting thing, most likely going to stay.
And Chair Smith, Chair Manning, Representative Marsh, we do agree with that. And when we look at across other states on the West, we are in the middle of that group. We want to get better at that, which is why we're proposing legislation and changes that will help us get farther along that path.
Okay. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for encouraging this important conversation. And I think we are making some progress, whether it was under Senate Bill 55 last time, Senate Bill 89 this time. 89 is going to take any debt over 90 days and refer it all from a variety of agencies over to revenue for a consolidated approach. Because, for example, the Mortuary Board, which is owed about $150,000, does not have a robust collection process in place, and we're going to send it off to the people who do.
Mm-hmm. But even their clientele, one could draw that conclusion.
So I think we're making some progress, and I'm pleased to hear that not only are we going to send that debt to revenue, but we're also going to give them some resources to pursue it. Senator Johnson mentioned tax scoff laws, and it's remarkable to me that the people who send in tax returns each year but don't send a check or create a payment plan is consistently about $600 million a year. Mm-hmm. People that are just saying, I'm making money, but I'm not creating a plan to pay my obligations to the state. So we're doing something on the front, Mr. Chairman, of collecting delinquent debt.
but I think there's some other things that we are not talking about, and I'll give you one example that just makes me crazy, and that is that there may be an organization, a corporation, a business out there that owes money to Agency A, but is being hired by Agency B to do a job, and because of our antiquated and uncoordinated computer systems, we can't track the fact that somebody we're sending money to owes us money over here. Now, that's not going to be taken care of by a collection agent in the Department of Revenue, but it's certainly a kind of issue that makes Oregonians absolutely barking crazy. So I hope that those are some of the other kinds of issues that we can look at going forward on how we begin to reduce this ominous problem. The other thing we have to do quite realistically is assess this $3 billion and talk about how much of it is real debt, how much of it is fake debt, that is debt that we just put on the books to send a statement that we ever hope to collect, and how much of it is delayed debt that we don't expect to get this year, but I hope that we're going to get next year or the year after. There's a lot that we can do on this problem, and it's a deep problem, and the fact that Oregonians are being asked to do more with less is a real problem when there's other Oregonians out there that just simply aren't doing their share.
Amen.
Excellent.
Before we leave this topic, I just feel compelled to at least note for the record that some of the accumulated debt at OHSU is charity care debt. And because of because of OHSU's tertiary status as an emergency hospital, they frequently end up with very expensive, very complex cases and people unable to pay. And I just want to make sure that's on the record.
So, Chair Manning, Chair Smith, as we move off of this topic, I did mention, and I'll mention it again, that those two positions are eliminated as part of the governor's budget. Part of the reason for that is that there is duplication of effort in some ways that's going on here. Legislative Fiscal Office does a report every year as well. And so our office, Chief Financial, does that as well. I think this is good work, but in the face of a $1.8 billion cut, there's lots of hard choices, and this will be an ongoing conversation, I'm sure.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, just a process check. We had hoped to get through the Chief Financial Office today as well as the Chief Human Resources Office, and we've got 35 minutes left.
Well, does any of the committee members have an issue or any burning questions to let them kind of proceed through the presentation?
I think we have five more slides for CFO.
I can roll.
Okay, well, we'll get you through your five more slides, and then we'll say the ammo for the next person.
Chair Manning, I never get out of the way of the fire line fast, so I'm sure there may be other questions. We roll through this. Let me roll to the next page very quickly. This is the budget for both the Chief Financial Office, those four sections we talked about, and DAS Business Services, which is on the right. What I want you to notice here is the Chief Financial Office budget is going down. The largest thing, I'm a finance person, just like some of you are, and I like one-time costs. 2 years ago, the legislature gave us $2 million to do assessments of facilities. That's something we've been working on very hard, and I will have a slide that will show you some of that. We are not proposing to do that for the next 2 years. We're putting a pause on all that. And we have program cuts inside the Chief Financial Office I'll mention in a little bit. One of them is what we've been talking about with the Senate Bill 55 positions. On the DAS Business Services side, which is on the right, that budget is growing dramatically from $7.3 billion up to $12.6 billion. But $7.9 of that is all the centralization of DAS's state government service charges into this budget. If you exclude that, the budget for DAS Business Services has actually dropped down to about $4.8 million, which is actually, we have cuts in that program as well, which I'll end up on the final page. So the growth in that budget is really a moving money across, as Representative Fahey mentioned earlier. It's centralizing to actually streamline our payment processes inside of DAS. I will skip over this fairly quickly. This is really about what drives the budget, and it really comes down to information requests. The Chief Financial Office is a information broker, if you will, primarily to the governor, secondarily to you and agency directors. And this was just some examples of what is driving the cost inside of the Chief Financial Office over time, which is really about the information demands coming from decision makers. This is the piece I will spend a second on. Over the last 4 years, this committee has invested basically $2 million per biennia to do assessments on state buildings. We have done a very poor job in the past of actually monitoring our physical assets. As you can see, we have 22.8 million gross square feet owned by the state of Oregon across 22 agencies or so. Total replacement value of all of those assets is about $4.8 billion, and this is not lease space. This is owned space. Over 6,000 facilities and 41,000 people in those facilities. Over the last 4 years, this committee invested in ongoing assessments of the status of those buildings, and we found as part of that that some of our buildings we've done a good job with. You can see on this list the facility condition assessments we've done for all DAS-owned facilities, Oregon Youth-owned facilities, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, Department of Corrections, Fish and Wildlife, Department of Transportation, and about 70% of the Department of Forestry. What we're finding is that the Department of Ministry of Services buildings overall have a mechanism of charging ourselves rent, and we call it a depreciation fund, which allows us to have money to actually have ongoing expenses paid for maintenance and repair of buildings. Many of these other organizations do not have that mechanism, and the quality of their buildings is not as high as what you see where you have that depreciation count in place. The other part that has come out of this is that with resiliency, you will hear tomorrow probably, and you heard from Director Koba earlier, that there is an investment in the governor's budget for planning around a seismically stable building that could be operational afterwards. Part of that comes from the work that has happened over the last several years that, as Director Koba mentioned yesterday, on the Capitol Mall, there is probably one building that continues to be operational after a Cascadia event, and that building is a transportation building. The idea behind that project and what came out of this is that we need to have another place that can be a seat of government so that you all have places to go if this building is not repaired, but also that we have a place that headquarters of state police, people issuing food stamps, all those other supports can actually continue and government can continue to serve the citizens after that kind of catastrophic event. The interesting part with that is that when you get into these kind of buildings, you have to do a lot of passive planning because you no longer have the electricity load you did before, which means you've got to have passive heating systems and other things that make this building operational long term. But all of that work was genesis out of what we found as we did these facility assessments. Finally, sorry, Mr. Chair, was there a question?
No, go ahead. Right.
So this is the final slide for the Chief Financial Office, and I will slide out of the way. There are about four reductions in this budget. The first one is just reductions in service supplies, pencils, paper, things like that, across about $100,000, roughly speaking. We've already spent a fair amount of time talking about this, the delinquent debt oversight functions, which, again, very good work that's been happening on that side. The last two are, I don't think we've spent a lot of time talking about customer utility boards. Over the last 4 years or so, the service side of the Department of Administrative Services created these, if you will, customer boards. We call it customer utility boards for the agencies they're required to get or purchase services from the Department of Administrative Services. This is facilities. It can be the technology services. And these customer utility boards are a group of agency business leaders and agency directors that kind of overwatch the services that DAS is providing, and it gives them a forum to actually push back or have conversations about what their rate structure actually looks like. The Chief Financial Office has been providing a lot of the administrative support for those, and what this change does is it eliminates two positions and pushes that responsibility back to the individual divisions, which would be the Chief Information Office, the Chief Human Resource Office, and the Enterprise Asset Management and Enterprise General Services. The final one on here is that DAS has, Chief Financial Office has a position dedicated to doing customer survey support. And we do this for inside of DAS, but also for other agencies as well, and it's proposed to be reduced in the governor's budget. With that, Mr. Chair, I will pause and see if I have any other incoming questions.
And we do, Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can we go back to the facility planning slide right there? You know, to me it seems like there is a large hidden cost in state government that's being ignored in the depreciation of many of our buildings, and this body, not you folks, this body is responsible for, because as we craft budgets we continually leave out that non-cash expense called depreciation. We don't prepare for it. And yet what ends up happening is we put off painting, and then we put off changing the light bulb, then we put off doing the heating system, and the next thing you know, you've got the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the whole roof caving in on us. And at some point in time, and I don't know how you do it, especially in a situation like we have this biennium, but at some point in time, this body really needs to get its arms around that non-cash expense called depreciation and what that means to Oregon's assets. And I guess that's more of a statement. I don't know if there's any way to calculate what that depreciation expense is that's been ignored for so many years on so many assets.
Yes, Monday.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I could follow up before you answer one other, I agree with the co-chair completely. But the other question is the cost of mothballed buildings.
Yeah, right.
One that comes to mind right now is the Oregon Youth Authority facility in Warrenton, which may or may not be closed. Obviously, I'm not very happy about the prospect of it closing. But because that is a one-off building, I mean, you're not going to turn it into a Bi-Mart. It's a prison. And it is right adjacent to the sheriff's office in Clatsop County. I have suggested, instead of us keeping the ongoing cost of maintaining it mothballed as a one-purpose building, give it to the county. Let them repurpose it for an adult correctional facility. And because I'm not a corrections engineer or an expert in that subject matter, there may be some costs in doing it. But I just learned that one of the other youth authority facilities is costing us $500,000 a year to mothball. And I don't know where the calculus comes in about how long do we mothball it, if it's going to be scraped in the long term anyway and the land repurposed. I just don't know enough about the plans. But it's not just the day-to-day depreciation or the failure to maintain buildings and the concomitant effect on employees' health care in buildings with bad air or health condition. I'm delighted that you've made this progress. As Mr. Naughton said, two biennia ago, three biennia ago, we had thousands of square feet of unused space, and you're doing heroic work to get it corralled. But I agree with Mr. Smith about the depreciation. I certainly want to talk about the mothballs.
So, Chair Manning, Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, members of the committee, this has been ongoing work, and quite frankly, for those members that were with us when we first started this effort, at the time we started this, we had three different data systems that had three completely different data sets on what the actual square footage of the state was. In a weird corollary, the work we're doing on delinquent debt has some of that same kind of flavor, where the data has gone fallow for a while and we're trying to pull it all together. We are absolutely trying to make headway on this one. And I was a human services analyst for years. That state hospital building that was out there, that facility is built in the early 1900s, had $1.3 million set aside for maintenance costs. Nowhere even close to what it would cost to actually operate that building, which is why we're in the process of tearing it down. We built a new one. And now to go to Senator Johnson's question, we're actually in the process, I think that has actually broken ground. They're demolishing that building, the old buildings now, to get it ready for what are we going to do with it next, because no one wants to buy a building that was built in 1904, whenever it was designed back then, and even now is not usable. So that is absolutely part of the conversation that Enterprise Asset Management will talk about with you partly tomorrow as they go through this.
Just really, really quick, Mr. Co-Chair. The closest this body really came to understanding its depreciation needs was in 2008 when President Courtney and Speaker Hunt put together a list of economic stimulus packages of buildings that needed renovation. Do you remember that? And we just had that full list of everything. Sure. And we were only able to do a fraction of it.
Yeah.
But that's probably the closest we've come to really getting that full detailed list.
And Chair Manning, Chair Smith, this has been, as you can tell, an ongoing issue. We've been doing work on it. Again, we're not proposing new facility assessments. We still have staff that are working on this with the data we have available to us. But this is a big cost for us. We call it deferred maintenance in a lot of stuff, and most of our agencies and the university system can tell you how much they have in deferred maintenance, which is, in essence, just maintenance that you didn't do when you should have, and now it's been mothballing. It's not mothballing. It's been stacking up.
And, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, the mothballing issue, which I'm learning about more coming into this position, those agencies that own those facilities, like Youth Authority, the facility you're talking about, they have the first decision making on that facility, and if they choose to be done with it, then, as I understand it, it comes to DAS. So there is a process in place before we have control over it. When it comes to us, so we have the North Mall campus, which is the old state hospital building complex. We also have Fairview, which is now coming to us. That's not an easy thing for us then to take and manage either. So it's complicated from a whole host of places, but I would agree with you, and I'm not sure what Youth Authority would say about the notion of if they don't think they're ever going back to that facility and the county can use it, that makes good sense to me.
I've already broached it with them, so it's in the works, but I just raise it in this venue.
Good. All right, so with that, that's the end of the Chief Financial Office presentation. We're now have 25 minutes to go over the Chief Human Resource Office. We'll do our best to get through it, and if we don't, we can bring them back tomorrow and just squeeze the Chief Administrative Office side. So, Madeline, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, I am Madeline Zeich. I'm the State Chief Human Resources Officer. Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning. We have just a few things for you today. I might try and speed through a few of them, but I understand you were reserving some ammo for me, so I'm ready for you at the end of the day, best I can.
So. I was kidding.
I know. So a little bit about the Chief Human Resources Office. As Mr. Naughton showed you, this is the breakdown of the units within the Chief Human Resources Office. We're going to talk a little bit more about the HRIS, which stands for the Human Resources Information System, the Enterprise Human Resources Office, Workforce Solutions, Policy Development and Consultation, Strategic Planning and Innovation, Labor Relations, Classification and Compensation, and Information Management. And as you see at the bottom, the Chief Human Resources Office provides policy guidance and direct services to promote a stable and qualified workforce in state government. Basically, what we do is we manage 35,000 employees here within the state. 40%, as we heard yesterday, may be eligible for retirement in the next 3 to 5 years, should they choose to do so. So we have also millennials that we're trying to get into the workforce, so a broad range of employees that we are working with. One of the things that we also talked about yesterday was the need to have some acronyms explained, so I'm just going to go real quick. I remember I used to do this in school. One of my professors said, please tell me about acronyms, so I'll just give you some highlights on the acronyms we're going to talk about today. PPDB, when you hear that, that is the Position and Personnel Database, so that's what we're going to talk about when we talk about the HRIS project. PICS is the Position and Control Information and Control System. We're going to talk about that. That's a mainframe system when we talk about HRIS. And then EHRS is the Enterprise Human Resources System. So I wanted to bring those up right away. Thank you. Oh, that's good. So a little bit about policy development and consultation and how we develop policies in HR. I've been here about 3 years, and one of the things that I observed is how well the enterprise leadership team was doing in collaborating with agencies. So I wanted to use that model and move that into HR. So as we're developing policies, at least over the last 3 years, we have a collaborative model, and I use a group called the HR Advisors. So I have 11 agency directors that are really kind of my kitchen cabinet, the group that works with me as we're developing policies within the Chief Human Resources Office. So we're not doing it in a vacuum. We're including agencies in the policies that we're developing so that we're implementing best practice, and we ensure that they are part of the solution. We also evaluate and lead activities related to statutory or regulatory changes. So if there's new legislation that comes out of the legislature, if there's something with the Affordable Care Act, if there's something that changes, we implement those through policy changes. Our labor relations group works collaboratively with 10 labor organizations to administer our contracts. We have 32 bargaining agreements for 33 bargaining units in 62 different agencies, boards, and commissions, so that keeps that unit quite busy. We also administer and negotiate 4 non-state employee bargaining units out of DHS, which are the child co-workers, the home care workers, the adult foster care workers. We manage the contract-related grievances, demands to bargain. If there are hearings before the Employment Relations Board, we work with DOJ on those. And then our Enterprise Human Resources and Employee Relations Unit, they're the group that provides direct services to 21 agencies that we serve directly with HR services. information management. We're going to talk a little bit more about that when we talk about the HR system. This team also prepares reports and analyzes data, and we're trying to build some capability around that because we haven't always had the information to provide good data analysis, so we're working on developing some competencies there. Classification and compensation. I know one of Senator Johnson's favorite topics. This is where the compensation plan for employees are developed. This is where we do bargaining surveys. This is also where we maintain the classification system. Workforce Solutions focuses on our values that we talked about yesterday. And what skills do we need to get the right people in the right jobs at the right time? We develop best practice workforce strategies, such as training. We're really focusing on leadership capabilities right now and leadership training. And then we also work with management education, organizational development, and we implement ELT's priorities that are set for us.
Before you proceed, I just want to put it out to the committee. If there are questions that you have, so. Let's go ahead and get those done because it looks like we may have to come back and finish with round two to finish this up. But in the event that we do, I don't want anybody to leave out with questions that didn't get answered. And, you know, we'll have to dig back later on. So thank you.
Okay. And now I'm going to. Was there a question?
Actually, since you invited questions, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Could you elaborate a little bit on the subject that was brought up by the director yesterday and which you just touched upon in terms of recruiting new workforce and what some of those strategies might be?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chairs Manning and Smith and Representative March, it is a challenge for us to recruit mm-hmm. a new workforce. You did hear Director Koba talking yesterday about her personal experience. What we're seeing is with some of the millennial workforce, they have, and I'm generalizing, so I apologize for that, but they have different expectations about what work looks like. Mm-hmm. I often tell our agency directors, we're going to be hard-pressed to find the new workforce that wants to sit in a cube Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, behind old antiquated computer systems. And do the work. So technology, we have found, is something that draws the millennial workforce to an organization, and we don't have that to offer. Certainly modernizing some of our classifications to make sure that we have the right requirements for jobs are important. And then tapping into that sense of innovation that the new workforce has. So when I talk to millennials and I teach a couple courses and we talk about mm-hmm. What is really meaningful work for them, I think one of the opportunities we have is the ability to give them work that provides passion in a service delivery component and really connecting with constituents. And so I think we can also do a better job of recruiting them from that frame. You know, come to the state of Oregon, make a difference. Here's what you can do for your communities and the mm-hmm. state that you work in. Mm-hmm. I think as far as it used to be, you know, when I started working, one thing, I was a single mom, and one thing that was really important for me was benefits. You know, I really needed an 8-to-5 job. I really liked, you know, having this health insurance and the benefits. That it doesn't seem to be as much of a focus for the new workforce. It's the meaningful work. It's being able to contribute to teams. And so it really requires us to restructure not only our hiring practices, but the way we operate, I think, within state government.
And co-chairs, Representative Marsh, I might add as well, I think the younger workforce really looks for constant feedback in terms of how they're performing. And so we have a lot of managers that say, go do your job and wave your hand when you're in trouble. And that's not what the new workforce looks for. And so I think it's a lot of it is teaching our managers how to be better in terms of coaching and mentoring, which is not always a strength that we look for in our managers. And so that's one of the areas as well that we're focused on in terms of training for managers is to do a better job of providing more consistent and constant feedback, coaching and mentoring their employees.
Thank you.
Okay, now I'm going to ask Lisa Assumption to come up and join us. We talked a little bit yesterday about how we've structured a lot of the ELT programs, and so I know that many of you know Lisa, but I'll introduce her. She's the director of the Parks and Recreation Department. She's a member of the Enterprise Leadership Team, and she's my sponsor on the HRAS project.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Sumption. I'm the director at Oregon Parks and Recreation Department and a member of ELT and the co-sponsor of the HRIS system. So thank you for that segue in, because as Madeline mentioned, you know, at Parks, where 36% of our employees are eligible to retire, so hearing 40 makes me even more nervous, right? And a real great story recently is we had a new employee who started with us, and they walked over to the desk and saw a phone with a cord. And I didn't understand what the reaction was. And I was like, I've never seen one of those. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So imagine if your first day, this is the system that you get to work in if you're an HR analyst, and the very first thing you get to do is you get to see a green screen. When they're very used to everything being a mobile technology, a tablet or a laptop, and they work on the go, this has to be very plugged in. And so, as you can see, it is a very old, antiquated system. It's more than 25 years old. It's written in old legacy COBOL. Most of those folks that can write in that language are either retired or will be, so it'll be very difficult for us to maintain the system going forward. It's very paper-driven. The paper that goes behind all these fields is about, I don't know, probably 100 fields, and they're not necessarily data that we need to be able to track. And obviously, that doesn't allow us or lend itself to get reports very readily available to be able to make policy decisions and or operational decisions. Parks is a very seasonal workforce, and we would really benefit from a system that would allow us to determine how we get operationalized differently. As you can imagine, all of our information requests are manually processed. Every employee gets entered pretty much every time that they are, for us seasonals, every time that they are brought on and every time that they go off. We have to touch the system with a brand new form. So if you could have a one time, the employee's in, that's their record, that's their portfolio, it would be greatly beneficial, I'm assuming, for many of us agencies. And imagine the human errors that are prone to taking paper and putting it into a system. So anyway, and the other piece that I would like to mention is the system support going forward. There is a real risk and threat that the system could fail and we will have to do something. So,
So I'm going to talk a little bit about give you a little more information about the question that was asked about the project planning to date. In 2013-2015, we received $2 million. We spent about $1.4 million of it. 2015, $1 million to get to the 2016 session. We received additional planning money in May of 2016, and it looks like we'll have a surplus because of some of the timing of the work that we can put forward for the 2017-2019 request, and the policy option package for consideration is approximately $18.5 million.
Okay, and one thing that you may be curious about is kind of the agency outreach. So the thing that's a little bit different since we've created the enterprise leadership team and the way that we're approaching these statewide initiatives and projects is that this is no longer DAS telling us how we're going to do something. This is actually DAS bringing us to the table as agencies and business partners to say, how should this work? What do you need out of a system? So the requirements for the new system were developed in 2014 with the assistance of all three branches of government and 13 different agencies. And they've been vetted and reviewed by the HR directors and managers. The project team currently represents staff from six different agencies, primarily via job rotations, and those include Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, Department of Human Services, Department of Consumer Business Services. This is really hard to have to name all these acronyms. Oregon Health Authority, Oregon Department of Transportation, and Department of Administrative Services. Those sit on the actual project team, and they're folks that were technical experts in their areas that have come to get the project off the ground. The steering committee represents all three branches of government as well, seven agencies and two boards, and Senator Johnson, I know you're going to ask me, it's Oregon State Marine Board, Nursing Board, and the Medical Examiner's Board are the two small boards that are sitting on there. So it's a representation of large and small agencies that are very excited about moving to something that could look like this. ELT, you've already heard enough about that, of who those agencies are. HR advisors are a contributing stakeholder, and that represents 11 agencies, and Madeline and team are meeting with them on at least a monthly basis. There's 38 HR managers across the enterprise representing more than 75 state agencies that have been brought up to speed and come along with us since the 2012. Some folks have turned over, but we have kept everybody up to speed as to where we are. And then we've recently launched a change management network with 20 agencies that are currently participating, so we can help prioritize. Think about the system you saw. As agencies, we've created what we call shadow systems to kind of accompany those to help us run our businesses. And I know that we've identified more than 75 of those shadow systems, if you will. So we've been working very closely with our IT lead to help those agencies figure out how we're going to transition all the data and get everybody onto the new system. So I think that is
okay. I wanted just to add a couple more things about the governance and the participation in the project, and then we're moving to the next section, but I thought I might stop in case there are any questions. We are subject to the OSCIO stage gate process, and we have completed all of the stage gate documents that are required so far, 11 of them. We still have to do an operations and maintenance plan and a security plan, but we won't decide that until after the contract is determined. There's also a 12-chapter LFO readiness assessment that we've been working with Mr. Cummings on. We've worked very closely with Mr. Cummings. We meet with him every 2 weeks. And then we also have an OSCIO STOE that works with us, an OSCIO QA, and then we have external QA through Gartner Group. So there is a lot of oversight. Lisa mentioned the steering team.
What's QA?
Oh, quality assurance. Thank you. I thought I was doing so well.
We have a question.
STOE is a strategic technology officer. They work out of the office of the OSCIO, the state chief operations officer. It really reminds you how many of these we use. So there's a tremendous amount of engagement and oversight in this project. We've worked really hard to try and incorporate best practices. We know this is a complicated thing to do, but you know, eventually we have to replace this system, and we're trying to put everything in place so that we have the involvement and the oversight and the transparency moving forward.
Senator Johnson?
Two questions. The first one is, at what point do you get so many cooks stirring the broth that you end up with, certain bridge project kind of analogies? Or I know that inclusive is good. I know transparency is good. But when does the initiative's momentum tip it over? That's question number one. Question number two is much harder. And I apologize for the boldness of the question. I have talked quietly with some folks that have gone through the stage gate process, and they have expressed enormous frustration in how the process contravenes common sense in some places. You know, the 16-page checklist. I'm the last guy that's going to sit here and say I want the state to blunder into another screwed-up technology project. But when do we immobilize ourselves with prophylactic processes that paralyze us?
Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, those are two really good questions. They're the kinds of things that keep me up at night for sure. I think that in answer to your first question is how much oversight is too much and how much collaboration is too much. So we've spent, as we've talked about, I've heard from 3 years planning for this project. I think this is the point in time where you get as much information as you can from all of those participants. Now we're at a point that we have a governance structure, and that is the steering committee with the two quality assurance folks. And so we're moving, after we sign the contract and we actually begin implementation, then there has to be a governance process where people are making decisions on a regular basis. Because you're right, if you don't have that all lined out and people don't know exactly who's going to make the decisions, things get delayed, it costs more money. So I think we're moving to a transition place where there'll certainly still be more collaboration and communication about what's going on, but the actual decision making will come from the steering team, the project sponsors, and leadership.
One follow-up. I presume that once you pull the trigger, the go, no-go decision has been made. I'm curious how long you have to assemble the project till it's done. And I keep thinking with bemusement and wonder at DMV's 10-year time horizon to implement a new computer system. I have a really nifty Betacam in my garage that I would be happy to share with people, because technology just, in a tsunami, overwhelmed my little Betacam. And I can't understand how you can have a 10-year rollout on a computer project and not have it look like a bunch of little Betacams all tied together.
Technology.
Co-chairs Manning and Smith, Senator Johnson, I want to make sure I get back to the second part of your first question, and that was the stage gate process. So I have some experience in that. Before I moved to Oregon, I lived in Nevada. And in Nevada, we had a number of projects that did not go so well. I've heard some names here in Oregon. I think they're similar to what I've heard. And so the answer to that was really to implement a process similar to the stage gate. And over the next few years, as they refined that, it became less onerous and more useful. I actually come from that framework. I used to manage, I've had a weird career, but I used to manage IT in addition to HR. And so I'm pretty familiar with that type of process. And yes, I have heard people be frustrated with the amount of documentation, but I do think it serves a purpose. And I think it will only get better as we use it to manage projects effectively and we start to see, okay, this worked and this really wasn't needed. But that's, again, up to the state CIO. I'm not the state CIO. And then as far as the project team goes, one of the things that we have been able to do is start to build the project team. That's what we've used planning money for. And so that project team, as Lisa said, is made up of agency experts that know the business in the agency. So that team's already together. So once we get approval and we sign the contract, there's approximately an 18 to 20 month implementation period for this system. Because it's software as a service, we're not doing the programming here on site, we're buying a subscription, we're not having to staff up with programmers and that sort of thing.
Okay, co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. You know, it's pretty obvious we need a new system when there's a picture of a floppy disk in the upper left-hand corner of the current system. I'm gonna follow up on Senator Johnson's line of thinking. What do you think the useful life of the new system will be? Just a best guesstimate on this.
So, co-chairs and Senator Johnson, I would like to add that the piece of the stage gate, as frustrating as that may feel to folks, it's actually made the project stronger. It's really challenged us to make sure that we're ready and that we're able to answer those questions. So for those that are not as IT strong, it has actually been beneficial to have that gate there to keep us back when we shouldn't be moving forward. And Co-Chair Smith, on your question, because we're doing this as software as a solution rather than something that we build and have to maintain, as Senator Johnson talked about, we don't want a bunch of beta cameras because technology, I don't know, it used to be 3 years it expired. I think it might even be sooner now. So this way we'll be keeping up with the latest technology. We look at it if it's good enough for the rest of the HR industry, and they'll keep up with where the world is going and the laws that are being implemented and the HR best practices that are out there. We'll be far better off and far better served with a system that is managed by experts.
So does that mean that we'll get regular updates to the software and it'll stay up to date on a regular basis?
Co-Chair Smith, will actually be paying for subscriptions, so we'll be getting the updates as those updates come out. So we'll stay current rather than being in the situation that we're in now.
Perfect. And just really quick, Mr. Co-Chair, I want to thank the director from State Parks for your help in my district. You did a great job. Your office did, helping us with some constituent issues. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I might just note that this project started really even before there was a stage gate. The initial meetings started before there was a stage gate. And our office took a very cautious approach because this is a system that touches every state agency, including the legislature. We all use these systems. And it's the first investment of what will have to be a number of investments because we have lots of legacy systems in this state. Payroll, there's a lot of other old systems that need to replace. So we wanted to make sure that the solution chosen didn't preclude other choices down the line for other systems we had to make. So it's kind of a complex thing to look at because we asked them to look at the whole of the system, not just this one piece, as they were going forward.
Very good. Obviously, we're not going to be able to continue out of respect to the committee members that have to go to other committee obligations and testimony. So I do want to apologize for my tardiness earlier. I had to do some testimony in support of an issue that was very near and dear to my heart. So we will adjourn and reconvene tomorrow at 1500 hours, which 3 o'clock for civilians. And it will be chaired by Co-Chair Smith. And until then, if there are no other questions, we are adjourned.
Same bat times.
Adjourned.
Same bat times.
We are.